Now, by the way, just a few things here. Yeah, Laura, by the way, you're a beard fan, are you?
A notorious beard fancier, yes. I made my boyfriend grow one when he didn't even have one.
Really?
Yes.
All right, okay. There's a few here just about what we were talking about, beards earlier on there. It says, apparently the film Sideways almost destroyed the Merlot wine market with the one line, "We're not drinking effing Merlot." I do remember that, all right, and thinking, yeah, the guy was such a wine expert, or felt he was, that, like, obviously then Merlot can't be good, so it didn't do it any good, and Sideways was a huge hit of a movie. The only person who could carry off a tash was Tom Selleck, Magnum PI, the man. Look, you had to have a tash to play for Liverpool in the 80s. That's completely true. Every single soccer player, every single Liverpool player had a moustache. Really awful. Personally, I loves me a bit of stubble. Three ladies en route to Dublin from West Cork. That's fair enough. I better not argue too much with any of that. Now, Laura is here, as in Laura Canning, because it's 50 years to the day when actor Sidney Poitier became the first black person to win an Oscar. Let's just hear a little bit of his speech here, first of all. This is Sidney Poitier.
Because it is a long journey to this moment, I am naturally indebted to countless numbers of people, principally among whom are Ralph Nelson, James Poe, William Barrett, Martin Baum, and of course, the members of the Academy. For all of them, all I can say is a very special thank you.
All right, 50 years to the day, but 50 years on with Idris Elba, the new heartthrob A-lister and possibly the next James Bond, director Steve McQueen picking up a string of awards for 12 Years a Slave, and this year's Oscars, and Mexican director Alfonso Cuarón winning Best Director for Gravity. You might think that racism in Hollywood is, if not well and truly dead, certainly in decline. Well, not so, according to Laura Canning from the School of Communications in DCU, who says it exists in various subtle ways. And we're going to examine those ways right now. So just take a look, Laura. I mean, it's been an interesting few years in Hollywood for black actors and directors, I would imagine, it seems to me as though, but certainly you can say there's a greater visibility for black actors. Has that changed things in general for the better?
Yes, it has. I mean, there's no denying it when it comes to how not just black people, but sort of ethnic minorities of all descriptions are represented.
I feel a big butt coming on.
if you think, for example, Mickey Rooney, obviously died recently. The one that always stands out to me is his Breakfast at Tiffany's role, where he plays a Japanese character, and is the most stereotypical, awful kind of buffoonery you could imagine. And that just, we wouldn't get away with it these days in any way, shape or form.
Mr. Yaniyoshi or whatever he was.
That's right. Yeah. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it isn't still there in a variety of much more complex and much more kind of embedded and therefore harder to unpick ways.
Okay, well then give us a few examples of the film where the racism is subtle but still very much present.
Well, it's kind of a tough one to pick out, because in a way what happens is it's absence rather than presence. So one of the things I found was looking at Michael B. Jordan. I don't know if you know the chap. He was Wallace from The Wire, if that rings anybody's bells. You still haven't seen it?
I've never seen The Wire.
Dave!
Sorry, yeah.
But a fantastic young black actor and a really, really talented chap who's really coming through the ranks. Most recently took the lead role in a film called Fruitvale Station, where...
Oh, yeah, I've heard about that.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's supposed to be great.
Absolutely fantastic. And again, it is a story of sort of black oppression and how a minority person gets sort of targeted within
Fruitvale
a police state.
I thought that was a documentary.
No, it's a fiction
film.
But he, for example, is a fantastic actor who sort of is starting to float between various big budget pieces of work and smaller budget pieces that are more concerned with actual race aspects. But he's recently been cast as the Human Torch in the new Fantastic Four film. And the reaction to him being cast in that role, I think, is where you get this sort of sense of that fault line, because there's been absolute outrage that they've dared to cast a black actor in a role, although this is obviously a superhero issue, this is a much more fluid kind of framework than a kind of a historical representation. How could you cast a black actor in a role where a white actor has previously played that role? So do you see...
Previously played on screen? Or in the comics originally or whatever?
So he's actually getting a great deal of grief for having taken a role which is perceived as a white role, whereas, as again, sort of black commentators have been commentating, there certainly isn't anything like the kind of angst about, say, Kate O'Mara, who plays Storm in the same reboot, her kind of Irish, French, Italian history, you know, how does that relate at all to her character? It doesn't, you know, but it is this absence. If you look at the list, for example, of films based on either novels or real life stories, where the original character was actually a person of colour, as we might term it, there's a huge list where they've actually been erased and rewritten as a white character. So Alicia Nash in A Beautiful Mind was originally a Hispanic woman. If you look at the entirety of 21, which is that film about MIT students getting one over those were all in real life Asian Americans.
Right.
So it's that erasure, I think, where the problem exists.
So there's the subtlety and all pervasive subtlety or all pervasiveness of it. Yeah. Okay, so how much has the makeup of the Academy, which is predominantly white and male, who choose the Oscar winners, contributed to the problem?
Well, this is the thing. We talk about the idea of media producers and media structures as being gatekeepers. So as much as it's about what you see on screen, it's also about who controls the access, what gets made, what gets financed, what is seen as having a potential shot. And in that sense, because we do very much still have this kind of old white man set of sort of ruling cabals at the top of all kind of financing and production structures, people's abilities to kind of make their way through that is continually hampered. I mean, there was a 2012 study of, for example, just the Oscars voting structure. And of the percentage of voting membership, 94% of them were white. So the film I mentioned, Fruitvale Station, when it was released, it was being talked up and talked up and talked up as a potential Oscar candidate. By the time it actually got to the Oscars, there is a sense in which there's only space for quote unquote one black film.
So 12 Years a Slave knocked everything out. Is that what you're going to say?
Absolutely. And that comes from, again, a sort of a, I don't mean to say non-political, but it's not a contemporary political story. It allows kind of commentators and so on to avoid awkward questions and contemporary
risks. Okay, well, let's take one that won an Oscar. Let's a little bit here from The Blind Side.
Does Michael get the family discount at Taco Bell? Because if he does, Sean's going to lose a few stores.
He's a good kid.
Well, I say you make it official and just adopt him.
He's going to be 18 in a few months. Doesn't really make much sense to legally adopt.
Leanne, but is this some sort of white guilt thing?
What will your daddy say?
Before or after he turns over in his grave? Daddy's been gone 5 years, Elaine. Make matters worse, you were at the funeral. Remember? You wore Chanel in that awful black hat. Look, here's the deal. I don't need y'all to approve my choices, all right? But I do ask that you respect them. You have no idea what this boy's been through, and if this is going to become some running diatribe, I can find an overpriced salad a lot closer to home.
Now, Sandra Bullock won an Oscar in The Blind Side.
Really good example. It's a really good example of something where, again, sort of black experience is being represented, but very much as the supporting act to the kind of wealthy white woman who comes in. And this is therefore.
But that was the story. Wasn't it based on something real that did happen? And like, what do you want? Change the facts.
No, indeed not. But at the same time, what you are talking about is bringing to the forefront stories that actually decenter black experience. The savior narrative, where what happens is that the kind of the white bourgeois middle class character comes in and saves the most fortunate black person. And it's not even necessarily that it's not important to tell those stories. But the thing is, I mean, you'd imagine to yourself, is it even important if we are in a country like Ireland where we still have a rather monocultural society for all that it's changing?
Yeah.
But actually it does matter, because the fewer representations you have available to you to choose from, the easier it is for those stereotypes, if you like, to get stuck in your head. Because the fewer real life experiences you have to kind of challenge those. Do you see what I mean? The harder it becomes to counteract representations, the more problematic it is for people who aren't being represented.
Yeah, one of the problems here, surely though, Laura, is the fact that, you know, it's not even the first rule of Hollywood. A prerequisite of making a movie is you've got to make some bloody money. It's a business. It's a money making machine. You put in, like, you have the stories that you have in front of you here. One of them is, hey, white woman, middle class, brings in black guy and makes him feel pretty cool, Blindside, stick Sandra Bullock in there, like, that's going to make money.
Let's go and print the stuff right now.
Yeah, so like with all, on one level, like, you can't blame the people in the business for making business out of it, i.e., you know, they have to make money.
But one of the curious things about it is how this stuff actually exists on an entirely parallel track, by which I mean there is money in black cinema. A really good example of that is a chap by the name of Tyler Perry, who makes these incredibly popular comedies about, it's him in drag, essentially. It's kind of like, it's a black American Mrs. Brown's Boys. It's probably the best way I'd put it. But this, the Madea series. And Tyler Perry has made about a dozen films, hugely successful stage plays, spin-offs, all the rest, that rake in literally billions. And yet you would almost never hear about them within the mainstream. They're extraordinarily popular and profitable. So there is money in this. It is as if there is a kind of an inability to see beyond existing structures and to kind of jump beyond them and
have a bit of courage. Who is the most stereotyped now in Hollywood, as opposed to just black and white? Is it Mexicans, the treatment of Arabs in movies, Hurt Locker, Argo?
Yeah, it's a troublesome one, isn't it? Because the kind of Arab stereotype has been a tremendous problem like throughout sort of cinema history. And a lot of that is, again, as with black representations, it's stuff that gets inherited from pre-existing cultural forms.
Right.
So if you look at the history of Arabs are billionaires, bombers and belly dancers, as the phrase goes in one account of it. So if you like, the kind of colonization of Arab nations in the 18th and 19th centuries, oddly enough, then gets pulled into cinematic representations of them.
Okay, well, give us just a few examples of movies where people will have seen the movies and where the racism is subtle, but it's definitely still there and they might have necessarily thought about it, but you're going to tell them.
Ooh, actually, that's kind of... here's a funny one. I would say something like Avatar: The Last Airbender. If anybody saw that M. Night Shyamalan one.
The Last Airbender.
There you go.
Dreadful movie.
Yeah, but one of the things that's really interesting about that is the way, in fact, it comes from a very popular graphic novel. And in that graphic novel, it's a remarkably multiracial set of representations. When it's actually translated onto the big screen, all but one of the characters is suddenly white. The only character that is not white is the baddie.
Right.
Do you see? So again, it isn't so much about how representations occur, because actually a part of a kind of a thriving set of cultural representations is not just that we only have good representations, because that's not helpful either. Again, Sidney Poitier had this whole thing the whole time. He got blamed by his own community for playing all the time the good black man, or the magical black man, as you see it now in things like The Green Mile, for example. It's that there should be a diversity of representations to choose from.
But what shouldn't we be up in arms? What about Darby O'Gill and the Little People and the Quiet Man?
Well, there you go. You would imagine that of all people, we would have some sympathy for this. I always love the story that in Providence in Rhode Island in 1907, Irish-Americans actually rioted over a film that was being shown called Murphy, which was, again, this whole stereotypical drunken, carousing Irishman. And they threatened to burn down the cinema and everything unless the film was banned and the local mayor had to ban it and so on. So you'd think we'd be a little bit more supportive to kind of diversity of representation.
What about the fantasy genre, like Lord of the Rings, Hunger Games? Is there much racism in those?
Can be very problematic, because for example, fantasy in particular has a questionable history and has, if you like, been employed by people with rather unsavoury politics to their own end. Even, for example, a lot of it leads back to Tolkien, who his you know, intentions may not have been problematic in themselves, but what he was trying to do was to create a kind of an epic which harked back to Beowulf and
right.
was in itself very sort of white-centred. But when you look at the making of that film, there's a great controversy about the casting of, for example, the orcs, the Uruk-hai, all of the Maori, the native New Zealand character actors in that film are all sort of heavily made up and kind of sinister looking and dark complected. And again, there is that sort of...
Wait a minute, what are you trying to say? It's anti-orc.
Anti-orc is a must end, yeah. It's a difficult one because, again, just the optics of it, it's just white equals good, dark equals bad.
I presume you're going to have
back.
A field day if I start mentioning cartoons and anything for under the age of 10, yeah?
Well, you know what? That's where... if you like, because we think that should be such simple entertainment, so to speak, quote unquote, but it really
more insidious
isn't.
There, I presume, than anywhere else.
Yeah, I mean, there was a great step forward, maybe, 1994, I think it was, The Princess and the Frog, where you had a Disney princess who was black, Princess Tiana, and it was set in jazz era New Orleans, and it was a wonderful little film. But it's very interesting because they were kind of touting the idea of it being the first black Disney princess, but she actually spent most of the film as a frog. So, you know, she was actually green for most of the film as an actual frog. frog. So it is a tough one. You can continually see and sense the studios kind of hedging their bets with
are
these
filmmakers
ones.
Racist?
Well, you know what? Some of them are. Let's call it where it is. But again, I think a lot of it is, again, this idea of the gatekeepers and kind of how structures perpetuate themselves. And if you've got the set of notional white middle class males making the decisions, because they don't necessarily see it as a problem, because it's not a problem that affects them, the incentive to change is not necessarily there. I mean, it's wonderful to see it changing. And you know, people like Steve McQueen are a very, very valuable part of that.
Well, that's Steve McQueen, the director, not the actor that I was talking about earlier on, who was cool.
Oh, yeah, no, the director, although the current Steve McQueen, I would like to state for the record, is a great deal cooler than the original one.
Right, I thought you might say that. Right. Yeah, he's the 12 Years a Slave director and Shame and all the Michael Fassbender stuff. Laura, I'm going to have to leave it there because we're coming towards the news. So listen, that's Laura Canning from the School of Communications at DCU. Thanks a million for dropping in this morning.